What's up, guys? Thanks for joining. I'm really excited to share this episode with you. I really enjoyed talking with Chris. He's got some fun stories and is just an all-around awesome guy. If you're listening to this on iTunes, don't be afraid to rate us 5 stars if you enjoyed the conversation. That really helps push us to the top of the queue and get more folks involved in the life in jiu-jitsu conversation. If you are streaming on an audio-only platform, you should know that the full video companion of the conversation is available on YouTube at Life in Jiu-Jitsu or on our Facebook channel, facebook.com/lifeinjitsu. As always, we're available on Patreon if you're inclined to support what we're doing. It's at patreon.com/lifeinjitsu. Okay, this is episode number 22 with Chris Lieben. Thanks for joining.
Chris the Crippler Lieben.
Right on, man. Thanks for
having
me.
Thanks for making the time, man. You and I actually don't know each other. We know each other through Mike Liera, right?
Yes.
And so I am down here for my nephew's baptism. And, man, I'm an uncle. It's so crazy how old age sneaks up on you like that.
Yeah. Well, I'm nearly a dad.
And you're so nearly a dad,
it
yeah.
It was a trip.
Yeah. So I'm down here to get Junior baptized. And I was like, you know, maybe I'll see if I can, like, get a podcast in while I'm down here. Because this is, like, the... You know, San Diego's like the mecca, right, of like MMA and jiu-jitsu. So I figured I'll start with my old training grounds, the arena.
Okay.
And I saw that you were doing the MMA course, the MMA curriculum here. And I was like, oh man, I'd love to have him on. So Mike set us up, and thanks for taking the time, man.
Yeah, like, of course.
And if I can just take a minute here and sort of just expand on something. I think one of the really positive aspects of having done this podcast for me is just I'm just kind of like really just surprised at the kindness that I've found in doing this. You know, people that don't have to take any time for me have been like, yeah, right. I'll come on, you know? And so it's really, it's kind of like uplifting in a weird way. So, but yeah, enough about my story, man. Let's talk a little bit about you. I'm kind of interested in just talking about your journey in jiu-jitsu and MMA.
Okay.
And sort of kind of looking back, you know what I mean? How'd you get started in martial arts?
Oh, you know, I think it was the same as probably a lot of kids. I started doing traditional kung fu and whatnot as, you know, kindergarten, first grade. And then I wrestled my third grade year, did some more karate and stuff. And then I started boxing in middle school.
Okay.
And then after middle school, I took boxing relatively seriously. When I started high school, that's when I really... started to get after wrestling. I started wrestling year-round after my freshman year.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's what I did at that point.
Yeah. Were you in high school in Chula Vista?
No. I went to high school in Oregon.
In Oregon. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I saw on your Wikipedia page that you're from Chula Vista. Maybe that was just when you're fighting out of alliance.
It's Wikipedia.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I think what happened is somebody changed it because I was out of alliance for a while.
Got it.
My last couple fights.
Got it. Whereabouts in Oregon?
Portland, Oregon.
Oh, cool.
Portland, Oregon, yeah. Grew up as a kid on Mount Hood, and then in the seventh grade, we moved right downtown.
Okay, very cool, yeah. Very cool. So you started wrestling year-round. Did you sort of, like, jump into those wrestling practices? Did you, like, know right away that you wanted to get really serious about it, or was it kind of like a slow...
You know, it's funny, I...
like, evolving thing.
Excuse me. I was really just a skateboarder. You know, and yeah. I hadn't done any organized sports for the most part at all. And, you know, I remember freshman year I got bullied by this kid, Maya. You know, he was a varsity wrestler. He was a junior my freshman year. He tried to trip me in the hallway. And
no shit.
So I was like, fuck that guy. So I went and talked to the wrestling coach. And I was like, hey, this guy wrestles. Hey, I want to wrestle.
Yeah,
you know, he's like, well, you know, the season's already started. You're a little late. And I was like, well, come on, you know, let me in. So, long story short, he let me jump in my freshman year a little bit late, and you know, I did decent as a freshman. I was 50-50. You know,
yeah.
Wrestling my freshman year. Then I went and spent the whole year training. And then I went back for my sophomore year, and the kid
you're just
Maya
taking names
was,
or what?
Well, that kid that tripped me was, you know, had the varsity spot. You know,
okay.
He was a senior now, so I went back and I beat him out for his varsity spot.
A senior year,
his senior year, and then he quit the wrestling team. So,
oh, shit.
Mission complete.
Mission accomplished, huh?
Mission accomplished, yeah.
You know, that's so, it's so funny. Like, I, I'm coaching my wife's son's wrestling team.
Okay.
Bradshaw Christian Wrestling and Go Pride. They, I come in and I help when I can.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
And it's really interesting to kind of like reflect on the difference between the wrestling culture and the jiu-jitsu culture. At first I thought like, it's made me re-examine a lot of my beliefs about jiu-jitsu because, about how jiu-jitsu relates to wrestling. Because I feel like, you know, oh, like you shouldn't be pulling guard in a street fight, you're going to get your ass kicked. Which I actually believe that myself, but controversial subject, you know.
It's, yeah, it's funny because, I mean, they're so similar, but yet they're so completely different.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I actually was listening to one of your podcasts. I can't remember who you had on, but you were talking about that.
Yeah.
The differences between, you know, the culture with, you know, and it's so true, you know, when I teach jiu-jitsu, I might spend 15 minutes dealing with how to hold the underhook properly and how to come out the back door, whatever it is I'm teaching. Whereas, you know, with wrestling practice, I'm going to show it 4 times, then we're going to drill it step by step by step, and then we're going to just hit it live for 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's so different.
Such, you know, and wrestling is kind of like, okay, look, here's a rough outline. Now figure it out, make it work for you. Do it 1,000 times.
Yeah, yeah.
Where jiu-jitsu is like, no, you got to tweak this like this, you know, a little bit like that. Definitely a different eye to detail.
Yeah, we were at this dual meet, and I've always had this like this notion that like, you know, jiu-jitsu and guard pulling, you're gonna get your ass beat in a street fight. And I kind of felt like wrestling didn't really have that, but now that I really look at wrestling encourages you to give your back up. You shouldn't be doing that in a fight. You know, like if someone's behind you, wrestlers will just kind of stand up and like that.
Right.
I think that's kind of dangerous, actually. Now that if I really think about it, and then also, when you're like shooting in on a double, and the person's trying to spin around and come behind you, and you might just like leave your arm out like this, trying to hold onto that leg so you don't give up the points. You get crucifixed. You get ground and pounded really bad right there.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And so I have to kind of take back what I said about like wrestling not having any of those like absurdities in the rules that are really against self-defense.
I will say though, from experience, you know, having cornered hundreds of fighters and you know, that as far as a foundation goes, I think there's nothing that can be modified to be fight ready quicker than straight wrestling.
Yeah.
You give me 2 weeks with a straight wrestler, if they're halfway decent at wrestling, I think that they beat a lot of amateurs.
Yeah.
After just, hey, this is how you posture up in guard. You know, you already have good pressure because you're a wrestler, so this is how you keep your head up, your hips in, you know, you hit, you know, can be hard to deal with.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So you, what came after high school wrestling for you?
So after high school wrestling, I had a couple colleges were interested in me for wrestling.
Okay.
You know? But I really didn't read or write well at the time, like at all. It's kind
like
of
at
fun.
All. Wow.
It's a funny story. You know the whole grew up on the wrong side of the tracks thing.
Like a cliche for a lot of people, but that's a real thing. Like,
yeah,
that's a real thing. Yeah.
I had a rough upbringing. And so as a reflection of that, you know, growing up, I was always told, hey, you know, my mom was told this kid will never read or write. But the fact was, nobody was ever trying to teach me how, you know, and I really wasn't interested.
Yeah.
It took me about a year. Once, back when MySpace came out, and I had the motivation of trying to get laid. It took me about a year to learn how to read.
Then
and
you
write.
Started,
and now
so you could slide into the DMs.
Funny story.
You learned to read, and so you could slide into the DMs.
I'm relatively proficient at reading. Now I read books all the time.
Good for
and,
you, man.
You know, and I write. My spelling is still not good. It's not good, but with spell check and everything else, I can get by.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So it's funny, you know, finding motivations for things.
Yeah.
Yeah, so long story, I thought I would wrestle for the Army. My recruiter said, yeah, they came out, they looked at you, they love you. Long story, I got selected. I went 82nd Airborne. And then I got to my base, and my first sergeant said, yeah, but we're understaffed in your position, so you're not going to even go try out for the team.
This is like the Jarhead thing where he thinks he's going to play the trumpet.
Right, yeah, totally. So, you know, don't thank me, thank your recruiter kind of thing. And, you know, being
That's so ugly how we do that.
Being an 18-year-old kid at the time,
You're just like, okay.
I did the only logical thing, and I jumped in my car, and I drove from Virginia to Oregon.
Oh, good for you.
went to the Civil War game with some of my friends, got in a frat fight, got thrown in jail. ultimately got kicked out of the military for that one. And then...
When you look back, do you think that was maybe a blessing, getting kicked out of the military? Or I don't know.
I mean... Now that I'm older, it's always going to be one of those dark spots that hangs over me.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? I'm a patriotic guy. I believe in our country. You know, I do a lot now to support the military. Yeah. But yeah, I've been to a dozen different countries. You know, supporting the military and doing cool stuff for MWR and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, so I have that over my head. It's not something I share. Since we're talking about it, I'll tell you. But
okay,
it's not something
sure.
I don't just jump on it in any conversation and just spit that out.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's definitely a darker spot. But yeah, you know, I got a job selling cars. And my car salesman, used car salesman, is an interesting career.
Oh, yeah.
You probably it's not the most honest job on the planet, if you couldn't guess. A, and then B, used car salesmen, they bounce around from one spot to the next. Well, my brother got me the job. Then he switched to a different car lot. Then I got a call one day, and it was my brother, and he says, Chris, dude, I'm selling cars at this place on way out on Stark, and Randy Couture and Matt Lindland are kicking the shit out of each other in the garage.
You're joking.
No, dead serious. So,
oh my God.
I said, what? I'm on my way, you know? So I jumped in my car. I sped down there. It's where I met my coach, Robert Follis, and,
rest in peace.
Yeah. We have his wake is, actually tomorrow.
So oh, wow.
I'm driving to Vegas for that. But you know, one of the greatest coaches of all time, yep. You know, and
the guy's an institution. He was,
he's it's a list of who's who. You know what I mean? As far as who he's coached. I mean, just the early days when I was on the Team Quest team, it was me, it was Ed Herman, it was Chael, it was Randy, it was Matt, it was Dan Henderson, it was Evan Tanner,
Couture.
Yeah, Randy Tour, all those guys were all...
Those were like the American wrestling crew that came in to take over MMA in the early days.
And they really did. They really did. So I was actually the 12th student ever at Team Quest.
No shit.
So when I started there, literally, they had just thrown... They had ripped out the mechanics tools and just thrown a wrestling mat down in the garage where they were fixing the cars before they sold them. You know, there was an old bus.
So Team Quest was out of a used car lot?
Yeah. Matt Lindland's USA Auto Wholesale.
Good job.
Yeah, on 181st and Stark, Portland. Rockwood.
In Oregon.
Rockwood, which is the most... ghetto part of Portland, Oregon.
No shit.
Yeah, it's a rough neighborhood. Yeah, which it's relatively close to where I grew up. They call Felony Flats. It's nothing but...
That's going to hold a kid back to be from Felony Flats.
Yeah.
Going to hold somebody back.
It's funny because we all have our ghettos. I mean, all white people. But you see, it's one of those places where everybody's on crystal meth. you know.
Shit, yeah.
Everybody's on crystal meth, and, you know, there's more adults riding Huffies than kids, you know. you know, a common thing to see is a dude riding a little Huffy with a VCR under his arm, you know, and a steak knife in his back pocket, you know. Like, that's, you know. That's where I grew up. That's Rockwood today.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the, and I don't want to get too far off on this tangent, but I will just say this. I think that one of the most harmful things that the liberals have done for, you know, that the liberal sort of movement has done for this country is break things up in terms of race. I think back in the 60s and the 50s, a lot of those conversations were about who's advantage and who's disadvantage were mostly along the lines of black and white and race in this country.
Right.
But now it's like, man, like white poor people have a real struggle,
I think,
too.
The way that I said it, I said all white people, but I didn't mean it like that. What, you know, exactly what I meant is, you know what? Everybody there was impoverished.
Yeah.
We were all, everybody was poor in my neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody had money. Everybody was on drugs, you know? And it doesn't matter what color you are. When you're in the ghetto, you're in the ghetto.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's the bottom
absolutely.
Line.
Yeah, I think I was trying to say something similar to that too. So, hey, okay, so you're at USA, you're selling cars, and your brother calls you and he says, "Hey, these two guys are kicking the shit out of each other."
Yeah. So I come down, I meet Robert Fallis.
Yeah.
And you know, he signs. I'm like, "Well, you can sign me up," you know.
Yeah.
And so he didn't let me train that first day. Still mad at him about that. You know, made me. So I signed up, and you know, I started on as a regular student, and you know, really from then, from that first day, Robert Fallis always had this story he liked to tell about me. Every single day I came in the gym, he'd say, "Hey Chris, how you doing?" I said, "Hey, did you give me a fight yet?" You know, every day he said, you've only been training for one day, Chris. That's great. Did you give me a fight yet?"
No.
So I did that, and that actually, I probably fought too early. I fought about, you know, I had a wrestling foundation, but I trained every day.
You fought a lot too. I mean, you got close to about 40 professional fights.
Yeah, about 40.
And then however many amateurs?
So I had my first fight after training with Team Quest for about 6 months, you know.
Okay.
And from there, you know, being a kid from the ghetto that nobody cared about, that nobody expected to make it, to do anything, for me to have, you know, people talking about me, my name, to be able to go out there and fight in front of people and get that respect and stuff, you know, I mean, instantly, I was hooked.
You're hooked.
Yeah. I remember...
A little bit of an adrenaline rush and like a dopamine fix, right, too, when you...
Sure. I remember walking out to that first fight. It was at the FCFF, which is Chael Sonnen's show, which is still going. So he does...
Really?
Yeah, he rents out the Roseland Theater, does the Grappling Underground.
Yeah.
And then the next day has the FCFF, which is his amateur fight show up there.
I had no idea.
Still going.
Man, talk about a guy who's just like done it all, right?
Chael?
Yeah.
Yeah. Chael's a stud. He looked really good this weekend, by the way.
He did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Rampage. I thought Rampage was going to get... In my mind...
He looked real good. Rampage didn't look too good.
Yeah. But in my mind, I thought Rampage was like tailor-made to beat Chael. I feel like Rampage's boxing was maybe just as good, and Rampage is a wrestler as well. And so I keep thinking to myself, man, where does Chael go to win this fight? Like, the boxing is good on Rampage, the wrestling is good on Rampage. Like, it's kind of, you know, like, I didn't see like a stylistic hole for Chael to exploit, and boy, was I wrong. I mean,
you know, Chael
looked quick, man.
I actually only got to hear about the fight.
Oh, really?
Didn't get to watch it, but you know, I heard he was actually striking with Rampage.
Yeah.
Which surprised me.
Yeah.
Chael's wrestling is, I mean...
Amazing. Yeah.
As far as the practice room goes, I've never wrestled with anybody better. If Chael wants to take you down, if he wants to hold you on your back, you're not getting up. He's a strong force on top. Definitely those early years he gave me... I spent a lot of time on the bottom.
Wow.
That's for sure. But yeah, he did really well this last fight. So, you know, getting older, still doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I talked to him about a week ago. Hopefully I'll see him tomorrow.
You know,
hopefully he'll be at this thing tomorrow. So I know, I talked to Nate Corey. Nate Corey will be there. Ed Herman will be there. So some of the guys from Team Quest will be
here.
The one in Vegas. There's actually a couple of them. I think there was one last weekend in Portland, Oregon for Robert. And then now this one is in Vegas. So
Let me run something by you since Chael is a little bit older. You know, I was looking at like one of these last UFC events. And it's like, man, I think the average age on these guys
has dropped. It's dropped substantially.
Yeah, yeah. But then you get guys like Cormier. He's 38.
38, but see, that's not... It's funny because, you know, I think the days of seeing guys, you know, like Randy Couture's and stuff fighting, you know, when they're 45 years old and stuff, I just, you know, I don't think we're going to see that anymore. Not with kids, you know. It's not uncommon for a kid nowadays to start doing jiu-jitsu at 8 years old.
No.
You know what I mean? And
my nephew.
Those kids.
Yeah. My nephew's 2 years old.
Yeah.
My brother-in-law is trying to get him to do an armbar.
There you go.
I'm like, chill out, dude. He's two. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I started, the highest belt we had in Oregon was Matt Thornton. Matt Thornton, I think, was a purple belt.
Yeah.
You know, that was the baddest dude in the whole state. You know, and there was five real submissions, you know, and maybe six positions, you know. Guys, when they got into fighting, they could go a long ways on their wrestling career, you know, or their boxing career. And it took a lot of time for people to catch up with them. But now you got these kids that are starting fighting it's going to be like the sport now, it's like baseball or basketball or anything, you know, where, hey, if you didn't start when you're six, you're never going to make it, you know? And, you know, you're going to have that window you'll be able to play through. You know, most people will play through their 20s, but once you start getting into the late 30s, I think, you know, we're going to see careers ending there. Guys fighting till they're 50, I think those days are gone.
Yeah, yeah, probably a good thing, right? you have a really good perspective on this because you're on the front line as a coach, and so you just kind of see...
Right.
Come in.
Come in. Sorry. He's like, is there somebody in my office?
Sorry, you said it was okay.
How are you doing?
How are you, man?
Good. Oh. Yeah, I'm like, who's in my office?
Bro, you look skinny.
Oh, thank you. Okay, sorry.
Thanks, brother. What a guy. What a fucking guy.
Yeah, he's great.
So, but yeah, you're seeing who's coming up now because you're from a coaching perspective, you're seeing the pipeline of talent.
Right. Yeah. Right? Yeah. I coach here full time at the arena and now I'm refereeing as well. So yeah. I'm pretty much every weekend or every other weekend, I'm at an event somewhere here in Southern California.
Yeah.
Refereeing and judging amateur fights. And it's amazing, man. It's amazing now, you know.
Just seeing, like, the pipeline of talent.
Yeah. We still get a decent... The sport still has some spots to grow. In other words, you still get a decent amount of guys that think they know how to fight.
Yeah.
But maybe they've never really even trained, you know? And those guys tend to want to go out and do MMA and
prove, yeah.
you know? So you see some of that, but then also you get the kids that are really good, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, he's, you know, this kid's 18 years old, you know, he's been wrestling his whole life. He's got 20 kickboxing matches already, and he's stepping in for his, you know, his first amateur fight, you know.
Against that guy who thinks he can fight.
Yeah. Well, that's the nice thing about the commission is we do our best to, you know, luckily it's not my job, but... They do work hard to try to keep the matches relatively as evenly matched as you can.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but sometimes, you know, you've got an 0-0 guy and you got an 0-0 guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, you...
So it's hard to really know their backgrounds.
Right.
Yeah. Andy Foster is an incredible guy.
Yes.
Yeah, he... I actually know him a little bit from my time at the legislature.
Okay.
Because we would... the way it works with those commissions is they get approved...
to do their thing for like 5 years or 10 years. And right. then it sunsets. It's like, all right, before we reapprove you to do it, come in and give us a report on how you're doing, you know? And so he came in and gave his like sunset report, just kind of like an update on everything that they're doing. And people were like, oh my God, like, yes, you're reapproved. 2, you deserve a raise. 3, thank you. You know, like, he's doing such incredible work in terms of like what he's doing on weight cutting, what he did on moving the weigh-ins forward. I mean,
yeah. I'm excited to, right now I work specifically for Camo. So I haven't made that switch to pro yet. They want me to get 100 pro fights before I start working for him. But both CSAC and Camo are really the two organizations that are setting the standard for the whole country.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, regulations, everybody, maybe besides, I think, you know, Vegas kind of always does their own thing.
Vegas has been sort of able to do their own things. Like, the market is so big, right? But
right, and they're the old dude in the game, you know. Yeah. But everybody's kind of, you know, following on. California's really setting the standard.
Yeah.
You know, we pick it up, and then next thing you know, all the other states start to kind of fall in line. You know, California's really been raising the bar and setting the standard for MMA and the commission involved. You know, the commission here, whether it's amateur or pro, unlike a lot of commissions that I've seen, actually serves a purpose and actually really tries to help benefit the athlete.
Yeah, they really try to, I mean, Andy feels a sense of, like, obligation to those amateur fighters, trying to make sure no one gets hurt, trying to make sure, you know, people have a positive experience, you know.
Yeah.
He told me this crazy story about, like, taking a fight around December for, like, money for Christmas presents, you know, like, he, like, had to, like, it was just, like, those, like, down and out old days of fighting where he's just... couldn't afford gas money to get back home, you know, unless he won the fight.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's cool that he comes from a wrestling and an MMA background. He, like, knows what he's doing, you know.
Yeah.
So, hey, so when you started fighting, you took your first fight six months in. How long was your amateur career? Just a couple fights? You go pro right away? How did that? You talked earlier about kind of jumping into it maybe a little too soon. So
you know, the days were interesting back then.
Yeah.
You know, things were different. I fought probably 10 times, you know, in Oregon and Washington, and then I kind of fought pro, and I went back and fought amateur again. Not something that can happen nowadays, you know. I fought in the WEC, and then went back and fought an amateur show in Oregon again.
Wow.
You know, these are things that are obviously not legal anymore, you know.
But back then it was just kind of like, it was the Wild West.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my first fight in California was at Hitman 2, the movie. It was Paul Herrera's show. I don't know if you remember him.
No.
He's the guy, you remember Gary Goodwrench?
Yeah.
Remember like UFC 8 when he knocks that dude out with elbows from the crucifix?
Yeah, yeah. He was in his panties for that fight.
He was on the receiving end of Gary Goodrich's elbows. That's Paul Herrera.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Still a big guy in the sport, does a lot. We fought down here in California, somewhere outside of L.A. I remember Chael went down with me. Chael fought Babalu.
Oh, wow.
I fought this kid, Junior, from their gym up there in Orange County. And it was funny because fighting was illegal at the time. So Paul Herrera had told everybody that he was just making a movie, right? And so you get there, and he had hired, it was an interesting show, because he had hired Vivid Girls to the ring guard holders. That was interesting.
So it was maybe like San Bernardino, like in the valley somewhere, something like that.
Probably. Yeah. I can't even remember. But long story short, because he was making a movie, you would get, somebody might get knocked out.
Yeah.
Then they would stand them up and raise their hand like they won, because the winner of each fight had to be predetermined.
Oh, that's funny.
So, and the cops were right there watching to make sure that, you know, that this wasn't real fight. Hey, no, it's Stacy. He's winning. We have it written here. It's all part of the script, you know. funny thing is I found out later Paul Herrera was actually betting on the fights. And he had predetermined outcomes. So.
Paul, you've been called out.
No. That's something like that. Like, you know, this is 15, I mean, I'm talking about 15 years ago.
Yeah. You know what's so funny is I was just thinking on our way down here, we drove my wife, I just shout out to Haley, man. You didn't have to drive down here with me, but she drove down here with me from Sacramento to San Diego.
It's a long drive.
To see my nephew get baptized. We stopped in Orange County to check out the surf, and she says, "Oh, I think I'm kind of hungry." So we go to the Orange County Tavern in San Clemente. We're just looking for a bite to eat, but it turns out that it's an off-track betting operation as well. So okay. They like the horses, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so we see we got a thing for an upcoming bet. And, you know, they got like the stupid names or whatever.
Right.
She says, "Oh, Taco Tuesday. I think I'll put $10 on Taco Tuesday."
Right.
And she must just be lucky because she, sure enough, Taco Tuesday wins the race and she wins like $150.
That's awesome.
Yeah. You know? And
I think I actually know where you're talking about. I think I've stopped there. But is it right off the highway?
Off the highway. There's that 76 gas station across the street.
Yeah. I have been there. I've done the same thing. I didn't win $150. I think I lost 10, but, yeah. You know.
But I was thinking about it. I was looking at it, and I was like, man, you know, what if we start like a betting operation for professional jiu-jitsu matches?
There you go.
You know
My agent, Bobby, one of my best friends, he started a online gambling site for UFC and combat sports. And after having, just to let you know, having watched what this guy's been through, I think he's invested over $1 million at this point. He's 5 years in, and it's so much work every day.
Oh, bad.
They had to go find some island off the coast of Europe where they had to get their .com or whatever.
That's where it's
there.
Wow.
They still can't get, nobody in America can bet, you know, so they have to mainly focus on Europe because gambling is fine over there, but it's frowned on here.
Yeah, man. Dude, all these things that you think that are like, oh, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll do that. Just doing this podcast, which is pretty simple, has been a lot more work than I thought it would be.
But it always is.
Yeah.
Nothing worthwhile is ever easy. You know what I mean? Yeah. For sure.
So I feel like I keep taking you off track, but it's okay. So I'm enjoying your story. So you're coming up in the old days of MMA, you know, the Vivid Girls and the predetermined fights, and you're sort of like, you start realizing, hey, I think this is going to be a career for me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, after that...
You were hooked right away, right?
I was hooked immediately. After that first fight, you know, I remember I came back and I told my girlfriend at the time, I said, you know, I think I'm going to quit going to school because I was going to college part-time. You know?
Okay.
She goes, oh, great, you can spend a night at home. And I was like, no, I gotta train every day, you know? So yeah. As soon as I won that first fight, I stopped going to school and I started training every day. Obviously, that relationship didn't work out well.
Yeah.
But then I about a year in, I moved into my best friend's mom's basement. She charged me $200 a month to live in her basement. And me and my best friend, we worked for the neighbor about 4 hours a day in the morning, remodeling an old Victorian house. And, you know, I did that for years just so I had enough money. And then, you know, by noon, I was ready. I was on the bus heading to the gym. You know, I get to the gym at, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, stay there all night.
Yeah.
And then, you know, go out, party, wake up and do it again. I did that for years.
Yeah, there's stories about you sort of like waking up at 5 a.m. to work, you know, gym at noon, then party all night, then do it the next day.
Kind of
burning the candle at both ends.
I think those days are over too. For athletes doing that kind of stuff, I think that's over too. But yeah, back then, yeah, definitely. I was pretty wild.
Do you, when you look back, do you think you would have gotten more out of your training if you would like not? Do you think you were maybe overtrained and like overtrained, underrested?
It's kind of just like really hard to tell because everything plays a factor. You know, anytime you change any little thing, it really changes the whole overall picture so much. And I feel like there's something to be said about that young I don't give a fuck mindset.
I'll run through
a wall. I'll drink a bottle of booze and I'll go out and I'll crush you. You know, that my level of confidence in the early years was pretty high, you know. And you know,
and that was seen in those fights, man. I mean, that's kind of what made you who you were, right? Was that confidence in the way that you could just go out there.
You know, when you get older and you start to learn, like, whoa, hey, this guy could actually hurt me. You know what I mean? Yeah. And you know, you start to have those thoughts. You know, when you take a couple losses and you start playing things safer. You know, and your game changes or evolves as you get older. Just like that, I think you know, lifestyle plays a huge effect on the training. Obviously, there's some fights where I was dealing with a substantial amount of adversity and, you know, I probably would have performed better then. But at the same time, you know, I've performed well sometimes when things were the worst.
Really?
Is when, you know, training has been one, it's been more important for my sanity, you know, and two, you know, things have been bad and I've had something to prove and it's given me the motivation or the push to take it to that next step. So.
What fights in your career stand out? Either because you won when you were going through a lot of adversity and the training camp could have been better, or because you lost and you're like, man, maybe that was winnable.
I mean, there's, you know, I definitely have them on both ends. You know, when I fought Brian Stan, you know, I was backstage throwing up and diarrheaing before the fight even started because I had come off the Oxycontin a little. My timing was a little off on quitting the pain pill regimen that I was on at the time.
You weaned off of it wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
So you were withdrawn.
Yeah, yeah. I was DTing and trying to go fight at the highest level. You know, but I've also I had a fight for Sport Fight where, you know, my opponent didn't show up. So I went out and drank a bottle of tequila after weigh-ins.
Oh, my God.
And then Matt Lindland called me in the morning and said, I got you a fight. Get ready. You know? So, you know, and I went out and I won. Well, I won that fight. So, yeah. You know, there's, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell. Everything I believe, the only way I can get any sanity out of looking back at the whole thing is to go, you know what, everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, here I am now, you know, in recovery, you know, and a coach and a referee. And those three aspects, you know, those that set me up to put me in a unique position to really have something to give. You know, a lot of these kids, you know, they don't listen to mom or dad. They listen to, you know, their tattooed coach that says fuck. Yeah. You know, and he's been through it. You know, I think I'm able to relate. You know, I understand where a lot of these young fighters are coming from. You know, I think it all, ultimately, the only way I can, you know, find any, I guess, solace is to just tell myself everything happens for a reason.
Yeah, you know? Right. What was fighting in the early days of the UFC like? You know, like did you have a vision that it would kind of take off the way that it did? I mean, it sounds like at the time there were still a lot of shows and they were kind of trying to figure out who was going to be the UFC, right? Like, who was going to be the big player in the market? They had the UFC,
well, WC, you know, I was Strike on Force. The first season of The Ultimate Fighter. Yeah. And I feel like that was pretty much a game changer for the sport in general.
Okay.
Excuse me. I actually just saw a post a couple days ago. It was like 14 years ago today, you know, so this was a while ago now.
Yeah, Kostjak with the crazy hair. And,
yeah, this Forrest is like 14 years ago the show started airing. And, you know, we didn't even know when they were filming it that they hadn't even sold it to a network at that point.
Oh, wow.
So we might have just filmed the show and it never would have aired, you know.
Wow.
And I remember Dana White telling a story about, you know, how I was telling him, you know, at the beginning of the Ultimate Fighter, I was saying, yeah, maybe somebody will recognize me and buy me a beer. And, you know, when I'm back in Oregon, you know, I had no idea how life-changing it was going to be. I had no idea that after that show aired, I was never going to be able to go to the shopping mall again without being recognized. You know, I was never going to be able to go. I mean, and even now, I've been retired for a few years. You know, if I go any public spot, somebody's going to stop me. You know, tell me they love my fights and da da da. It's pretty cool.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool. Sometimes it's a little annoying, you know. But
yeah,
most. But you know, it. you know, that first season of Ultimate Fighter was life-changing. Yeah. Life-changing for me and game-changing for the sport of mixed martial arts.
Yeah. I mean, you had a good persona, too. I mean, I feel like you were just, like, really TV-friendly, man. The tattoos look cool. You're, like, the tough guy. Like, your fights were all exciting. I mean,
right.
I can't think of a boring Chris Leben fight.
You know,
right? Like, you're...
They did a good job at packaging it to that first show. You know, they packaged me as the asshole, you know, bad kid, you know, and then, there was a little bit of that. Yeah. Definitely, it was a little bit cocky, you know, 22 years old, 21 when the show was filmed. But at the same time, you know, they definitely market it well, and I think that's really when they started. After that first season of The Ultimate Fighter, you really saw them starting to market fighters in a different way.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I almost feel like they kind of got carried away with that, where they kind of... Because I feel like you were just such a good antagonist on that show, you know? And you, like, you looked cool, and I mean, I remember, watching it with my mom, and, you know, she's like, oh, I like that guy, you know, he's kind of mean, but I like him. You know? But, you know, they kept trying to find that guy, in the subsequent seasons, and I felt like they kind of forced it, you know, like what they did with Junie Browning.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, you know, he's probably not that bad of a character, at least I hope, you know, but, like, they kind of, like, encouraging people to be the guy that you were, you know?
They absolutely, you know, encourage that sort of, it makes for good TV, you know?
Yeah.
You know, the other thing they do is they go in, they take all the books and TVs out of the house, and they fill it with alcohol, you know?
So all you have to do is drive each other crazy.
Yeah, it makes and have them fight each other. It makes for great reality TV, turns out.
Hey, what's Dana White like? What's your relationship with Dana, like?
I like Dana. He's definitely a personality. You know, what I said for years when I was fighting for the UFC, my answer to that question was always, he signs my checks. So I love him, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, now being older, you know, I really respect him for what he's done with the sport, you know, how much time and energy and work he put into the UFC and what he's built it into and where he's took it. And, you know, there's other things, obviously fighter compensation, you know, and there's some,
yeah. And just his treatment of some of the fighters too. Right. I mean, like, you know, when he said George St. Pierre owes the fans another fight after the Johnny Hendricks thing.
And right.
I was like, well, no, George St. Pierre doesn't owe you dick. You
know, right.
Like, for me, it's like, this is a guy that helped build your company, like, and for you to, like, kind of, like, have this press conference when he's away, you know, and speak of your champion like that.
You brought him in to lose to Michael Bisping.
Yeah.
You're trying to think, how can we get, you know, Michael Bisping has always been the golden ticket to Europe,
to England,
you know, for the UFC and those fans.
Man, they kept trying to keep that. They were trying to keep the Michael Bisping train alive. You know, Michael, no offense to you, if you're listening, you're probably not. But I mean, they gave him Hendo, you know, and Hendo was past his prime. I think, you know, they really thought it was a winnable fight. Then they gave him GSP. They wanted to see Bisping carry that.
And they stretched out in between fights, you know, substantially too. So yeah, absolutely they did, because the guy's a marketing machine, you know. You know, and again, you know, Bisping's awesome. You know, he's a phenomenal fighter. I think he's, what, the winningest fighter in the UFC ever at this point. He just had a lot of years of fighting. You know what I mean? He's just been fighting at the highest level for, you know, over a decade.
Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately, we all get to a time where, you know, it's, you know, you had an amazing career.
Yeah.
Time to move on. Time to be
pack
a coach.
It in.
Time, you know what I mean? Time to start doing gi jiu-jitsu, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You seem happy as a coach. I mean, you know, I didn't know what to expect coming here, you know, if you were going to be like all, because I didn't know, you know, if you're going to be like, all right, fine, we can do it. And then, you know, if you're kind of like a prickly guy. You seem happy. You got a beautiful wife and a newborn child. And you're teaching gi jiu-jitsu. You're teaching coaching and you're doing gi jiu-jitsu. I mean.
Yeah. So, you know, I definitely lost myself for a while when I first retired. You know, you spend
like being in the spotlight.
Well, there was a little bit of that. It wasn't as much that with me as it was my whole life, you know, the last, you know, 15 years, every year has been broken down into a cycle of three or four fights, you know.
Got it.
You know, where I wake up, I train, I go home, I take a nap, I eat this, I wake up, I train again.
Yeah.
You know, I have the fight, I get all the money, I go out and party, and then
I get all the money, I lose all the money.
I spend all the money. you know, to, you know, being like, well, I'm just coaching now. You know, and I'm making a fraction of what I used to make, you know, and, you know, so I'm not in Vegas at all the baller parties, you know, I'm not, you know, I don't have money to throw around, I don't have the nicest car anymore, I did really good at blowing all that stuff away, and then, so it took a while, you know, and then, but once I moved here to Arena, you know, and I think I've been here like, I want to say 2.5, 3 years
yeah,
now.
About 3 years.
You know, initially I thought I was going to, I had re-signed with Bellator when I started here. But then that's when I got the news that my heart wasn't doing great, you know.
I didn't know about that.
Oh, you didn't? No. Yeah, so I re-signed with Bellator a couple years ago. And in doing my medicals, you know.
The EKG came up bad?
Yeah, EKG came up bad. They did an echocardiogram, found out my heart was pumping at, my ejection fraction was at 14. Not good.
Yeah.
Not good. So at first they were like, you know, you need a new heart.
Oh my God.
We don't think you're going to have enough time to get a transplant. You can do no cardio whatsoever. Lucas, you know, the owner of Arena here is huge into diet. I think he's getting his doctorates in diet and stuff. And he also, his dog had the same heart problem that mine did.
That little dog? Yeah.
Fucking, if you guys don't know Lucas, he loves that little dog. And so he did thousands of hours of research on treatments for the heart, you know, for this dog. And long story short, you know, I sat down with him, me and my girl, and he put me on a regimen of probably 25 different herbs and supplements, you know. You know, between that and then, I quit drinking, you know.
Good for you.
I really, really changed my life around substantially.
Yeah.
You know, and I put health first, you know, that, you know, my heart has just been just tick, continuing to improve, all the way to the point where about 7 or 8, 7 months ago is when I actually got the clear from my doctor that, hey, if you wanted to, you could compete again, you know,
thing is just gone.
Well, you know, it's heart disease is an interesting thing. You know, people say, oh, it's hereditary. It's not, but it's, I believe that it was 100% stress and lifestyle induced.
Stress, alcohol, maybe substance, whatever.
yeah. Alcohol and my supplements and everything else, you know, not good for the ticker, you know. So since I live a very low stress life, you know, I live a block from the ocean. You know, I live maybe
here in Ocean Beach or PB.
Ocean
or
Beach, yeah.
Good for you, man.
That may be 2 miles from the gym. You know, I get up, you know, and I come in. I do what I love every day.
Yeah.
You know, I take care of myself. And so long story short, I was actually able to do my first jiu-jitsu tournament in over a decade. I did Worlds.
Nice.
Which was, what, I don't know, a month ago?
Yeah.
Maybe about a month ago did Worlds. So that was fun. And now I'm training to do my first gi tournament, so I'm going to do
Pan-Ams.
Pan-Ams, yeah.
My buddy Mikey, who is on the podcast, keeps trying to get me to do Pan-Ams, but I feel like fat and bloated and unconditioned and just like,
you know, yeah. I went.
Those gi matches are no joke, man. It's a lot of work, man.
Oh, I know. That's what I've been focusing on. I always jokingly said, you know, I'll start, once I retire, I'll start grappling in my pajamas, you know, this is my thing with gi, because I really didn't do gi my entire career, you know, but it's kind of cool that I left it for as long as I did, because now, you know, training here under Barrett, and it's like there's a fire lit in me, and every day when I come to class, I'm learning new stuff.
That's so cool.
Where if I go to a wrestling practice, you're not going to shoot, very slim chance you're going to show me something I haven't seen before.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Every day in gi, I'm like, oh, you break the grip that way. And, you know, so it's.
And the little anatomy tricks too, right? Like just like the little, it's so cool.
It's so detail based and so fun for, you know, an aging athlete, you know?
Yeah. Hey, so you got the call, you got the call, said, hey, you can compete again. Did you think maybe I'll give the Bellator guys a ring and tell them I'm cleared?
Yeah, I thought about it.
Are you going to do it or what do you?
You know, I thought about it.
How old are you now?
I am 37.
Yeah.
37. So, I mean, I think realistically, you know, never going to be where I was in the UFC, you know, where, you know, I had...
You're a contender,
Several, you know, main event fights and stuff of the UFC, the biggest show in the world. You know, could I sign with Bellator and, you know, get, you know, 20, 30, 40 grand, you know, to fight? Probably.
Yeah.
You know, probably. But... You know, with the new baby and everything, I don't want to really put my body through it. I don't want to put my mind through the stress. I know how hard I stress in a fight camp. You know, everything is about that fight. You know, and when you're fighting, you know, your family life, everything else suffers.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So there's that, and then there's also, you know, I have some goals as far as. Coaching and refereeing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and my goal is to get back to the UFC, but at this time, as a referee.
That's absolutely.
So cool. So I'm doing everything that I need to do. You know, I'm taking it slow. I'm working with Camo. You know, I'm getting all my fights. So, you know, I make all my learning curve is here before I go to CSAC and go pro. But, you know, I could be in the UFC for another 30 years if I make it as a ref. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to having, a half dozen more fights, you know. So
Bellator.
I don't want to put my reffing career on hold.
Yeah.
You know.
Let me ask you something. You talked a little bit about the kind of like the routine of fighting, how you're like, your structure was, well, this will just be a comment, but like you kind of lost after fighting because you lost the routine of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I was spending the night over at my sister's because, you know, we're here to visit with my sister. My nephew, 2 years old, he's got this movie. He has to watch it every night before bed. It's called Boss Baby.
It's yeah, that's funny.
He's got to watch Boss Baby every night before bed. And I asked my sister, because my sister's like big into like development of children and stuff like that. I was like, wait, so maybe because he's 2 years old, does he think it's like a new movie every time? Why does he want to watch it every single night? And she says, no, he knows it's the same movie. He knows, like, you can see him anticipating the lines and saying it with the movie. For him, it's the comfort of routine.
Right, sure.
You know, it's the comfort of like, oh, and like, now it's time for Boss Baby, and now I watch Boss Baby. And even though he...
And then I go to bed.
And then I go to bed, you know? Yeah. And so, like, you can see even at the youngest ages how, like, we crave stability and routine, right? And so,
absolutely, yeah, and you know, that's what I found over the years now is that hey, I'm one of those people that needs it, you know.
Yeah.
There's that old saying, you know, idle hands are the devil's workshop, you know, and it's very true for me, you know. If I don't have anything planned, if I don't have anything to do, you know. I start getting in my own head, you know, either I get depressed because I'm not training enough, I haven't done something right, you know.
Maybe I'll give my old drinking buddies a call.
There
something.
You go, yeah. You know what I mean? It's scary. So, you know, one of my things is I stay busy, you know.
Let me ask you something. You talked about sort of like the stress that goes into a fight camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that... it's sort of well known that like alcohol and substance abuse has a real correlation with stress and feelings of like self-medicating is really like a way to cope, right?
Sure.
And it seems now, and you talked a little bit about how you're in recovery now and you seem to be doing better with it now that you're off the sort of roller coaster. Do you find like you're better able to lead like a sort of like a mellow lifestyle now that you're done fighting?
I mean, 100%, you know, I think the hardest part for me was coming to terms with that every day doesn't have to be the greatest day in my life.
Yeah.
You know, because if I don't go out and have the greatest Saturday night of my life, I'm never going to have to deal with that Sunday morning. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So at first, you know, early sobriety, you know, getting used to staying in on Friday and Saturday night, that took some work for me.
Yeah.
That was hard. Yeah. Yeah, because I was like, people are out, they're having fun, they're drinking, they're playing pool, you know, and, you know, I'm sitting at home with my old lady watching Saturday Night Live, you know, what the heck, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But after a while, I realized, you know what, I get up, I get in the gym on Sunday, I get my training in, you know, I take care of my lawn, my house is clean, my meals are prepped.
You feel decent.
For Monday, yeah.
And not just in your body, but like in your soul, right? Like you feel.
Exactly, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And especially to a guy like you, good-looking guy, muscular fighter, you go out and get laid, right? Like, I mean, because you're still that, like people still remember you. It's like, oh, that's the UFC fighter guy, you know. Especially in a guy in a place like PB,
get a drunk chick at the bar. To come
you know, and so you're kind of like, it's those walking away from all those options got to be hard, right?
It gets
replaced with something steadier.
It was just so different, you know. If it wasn't, you know. Obviously, meeting my girl that I'm with now and being with her, you know, she's helped tame me substantially, you know. Yeah. But yeah, it takes a while, but you know, and it's one of those things where it's like, you know, with like lifestyle or even anything, a technique or cutting weight, you know, I wish that some of these guys, I'm just like. Like, I was coaching my team on Thursday, and I was like, I wish you guys would just fucking listen to me for everything I said. Because trust me, it's right, okay? Yeah. I don't know why it's right, but it's right.
Yeah.
You know? And it's one of those things where, you know, we've got to learn that on our own. You know?
Yeah.
Somewhere along the way, you figure out, hey, wait a minute. There's a middle path here, you know? And that's, you know, that's the road that I want to be on. For some people learn it sooner than others, you know?
Yeah.
I think I was a little bit of a slow learner, but I definitely come to that conclusion now.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you can't get people to change. The more I think about it, whether it be family members or friends or, you know, even professionally, you'd have people that, like, weren't quite fitting into the office.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, man, you'd be great if you could just change this one little thing about you. And the truth is, oftentimes, you have to go get whole new people.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than wait for somebody to change, you know? Because, like, people just come into it on their own. Like, I got a buddy of mine, Amir, and he'll be at the top of the sport one day. I train over at Alpha Male.
Okay.
And so under, you know, Uriah and those guys, Amir is just given his youth to it, and he's got the skill set of a UFC fighter, and he'll be in the UFC soon, I think, you know. But for the first 3 or 4 years that I knew him, I was like, dude, you don't have to stand and bang every practice, bro. You don't have to let me, like, put you out to the point where you, like, are passing out regularly in practice all the time. You know what I mean? You can tap and practice. It's okay. I know you don't want to, but, like, rather than get choked out, right?
Right.
You don't have to, you know. And even Danny Castillo, like, got pissed at him one time we were running sparring practice. Like, Amir, like, you can't fight like this all the time, you know. Like, no reason for it in practice. But, you know, and now he's sort of kind of, like, gotten it. He's sort of, like, kind of turned that corner, you know. He's, like, really, like, fighting a little bit more wise now.
Yeah.
But everyone around him was telling him, hey, don't do that.
Right.
But it wasn't until he decided to do it for himself that he turned that corner. You know what I mean? So
yeah, that's it. I mean, you can do, you know, for example, you know, with my fighters, I do everything I can to herd them in the right direction, you know, to kind of point them. But ultimately, they've got to figure it out.
Yeah.
They've got to figure it out for themselves. You know, whether that's an individual technique, or it's a life philosophy. You know, they've got to figure it out for themselves.
Hey, we're getting pretty close to an hour here, so I'll just ask you a couple more questions,
okay.
If that's all right.
Sure.
We'll get you out of here. Your view on the state of MMA today, I mean, Conor, Bellator is, like, making a run for it again. The titles seem to mean less and less today.
Wow.
just your open thoughts on this. What do you?
First, I love Bellator. Right,
yeah.
I think Bellator is, you know, right now one of the greatest things for the sport. You know, obviously, you know, some healthy competition here in the United States for the UFC is phenomenal. Conor, I'll be surprised to see him fight again, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, he made so much money boxing. I don't know. I don't know how that's going to work out. I'm watching like everybody else.
Yeah.
I think Khabib beats anybody in that weight class, personally.
I think Khabib beats anyone one weight class up or one weight class down.
As long as he can stay healthy. You know, the kid is unstoppable. And just the general state, you know, of what, you know, a lot of people, you know, from my generation like to piss and moan about fighters today and all their movement, and they're not wanting to get hit, and they're wanting to outscore the guy instead of knock him out and finish the fight like a warrior, you know. And you go, man, the sport's getting more and more competitive.
Yeah.
You know, and the bottom line is the sport is changing and evolving at a very high rate. And it has been. Guys that were, I'm not talking about 5 years ago. I'm talking about guys that were the champ 2 years ago, 18 months ago. They're not even contenders anymore. You know, that's how fast this sport is evolving, you know. And mixed martial arts is just that.
Yeah.
Mixed martial arts. You know, our philosophy, my philosophy is, if it works, I like it.
Yeah.
If I can do something, I don't care how ugly it is, whatever, doesn't matter. But if it hurts my opponent, I like it. I see that the sport growing and evolving, and, you know, but sometimes, yeah, I still get caught up on, you know, there's so many fighters. You can't keep track of it. A lot of guys are going out there and they're fighting to not lose as opposed to fighting to win.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, that sometimes is hard for me. If everybody fought the way I fought, I'd still be in the UFC. If everybody would just stand in the middle of a cage and slug it out until one guy fell down, one, I'd still be in the UFC. Two, the sport would be even more popular than it is.
Yeah, there needs to be that fine line, right? I mean, the way the UFC and all of these promotions run their roster, it's like, you won, you got to stay, you lost, you got to go home. And so it breeds, you know, these fighting not to lose type of contests, which no one wants to watch.
Every show they tell you, you know, hey, you go out there, you bang it out, you know, and we'll have you back.
Not necessarily always
true. It's just not true. You know, you if you're in the UFC, you're winning.
Yeah.
If you're losing, you're not in the UFC.
Yeah.
I don't care how exciting you are, you know. Certain people, you know, me, in my career, you know, there was a few times in my career where I lost two in a row. You know, I've seen high-level guys lose one fight and be out. You know what I'm saying?
Fitch,
perfect example. I mean, what, you went 10 in a row, lost one fight, see ya.
Yeah.
Because, you're boring, but, yeah, so... Always there's some stuff that, you know, I'd like to see, you know, addressed, you know. But but ultimately, I'm extremely happy with where the UFC is, where the sport of MMA is. I mean, a lot of these guys are, you know, household names nowadays. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's huge. We're, you know... I remember, like, the first time hearing about a UFC on ESPN, I was blown away. They talked about us on ESPN, you know. Yeah. Now it's like they've got whole shows about fighting.
Yeah, yeah, that's crazy. They got the whole breakdown shows. Last question for you. Your little boy decides that he wants to be a fighter. Mm-hmm. You encourage. How do you feel about that if that happened? You encourage him, you tell him maybe not a good move, like what?
Well, he's definitely going to train, you know.
Yeah.
He's definitely going to train whether he likes it or not. Yeah. You know? But, you know, ultimately, you know, that'll be his decision. And he's going to go to school. He's going to go to college, in my opinion, you know. I as long as he takes care of his schoolwork, you know, I'll support him. I honestly don't think that I would be that ecstatic about it. And then B, you know, as long as he has a plan B option if the fighting thing doesn't work out, because hindsight's 20/20. It's hard to make your living and be set for life off of your MMA career.
Yeah.
You know, you know, one in a million guys is actually able to do that.
Yeah.
You know, 99% of the people that make it to the UFC end up having to go get regular jobs afterward.
Yeah, and they're already the cream of the crop.
Right.
Yeah. All right, brother. Well, I think that's a pretty good place to leave it. Final thoughts from you or just anything else you want to...
No, thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Yeah.
All right. Thanks for the time, brother.
All right, man. Thank you.